I think that is the end of my technical reminders for our broadcast today. So, with this quick disclaimer, what I'm going to do is ask Clay Nelson if he could go ahead and turn on his presentation screen. Clay, I'm going to put your video up so that the audience can see it, and we'll get ready to transition over and officially begin today's session. And so, Clay, I can see the slides. I'll turn the floor over to you.
Great. Thank you, Jean. So welcome everyone to session two of our four-part training series on assessment of relative bioavailability of soil arsenic and lead in human health risk assessment. Today's session will focus on application of RBA data to human health risk assessments at soil arsenic or lead contaminated sites. For more information about topics discussed in today's training session, you can email the Technical Review Workgroup Bioavailability Committee co-chairs, whose emails are provided here. Please note that BAC co-chairs may change with time. You can also email the BAC directly at bahelp@epa.gov. We also encourage you to browse the BAC website, which can be accessed through the link shown here. Let's start with a quick recap of key topics discussed in training session one. First, bioavailability in today's context is generally defined as the fraction of total soil arsenic or lead that, upon ingestion, is absorbed across the gut wall and available for distribution in the body, where relative bioavailability, or RBA, is defined as the ratio of the absolute bioavailability of lead or arsenic in soil to that of the same contaminant in the standard used to develop the toxicity value for that contaminant. We are interested in assessing relative bioavailability because total concentrations of arsenic or lead in soil may not provide an accurate measure of risk. Rather, it is the bioavailable fraction that poses risk to human health. Therefore, including RBA data in human health risk assessments can improve the overall accuracy of the assessment, often with the added benefit of cost savings when inclusion of RBA data enables a reduction in the scope of cleanup or other remediative actions required at a site. RBA can be directly measured using in vivo animal models, commonly juvenile swine or more recently mice. However, to reduce needs for in vivo testing, increase sample throughput, and save costs, EPA has validated an in vitro bioaccessibility method, or IVBA for short, that uses a simple chemical digestate designed to mimic human gastric conditions and shown to be a reliable predictor of RBA, now known as EPA Method 1340. Finally, in training session one, we reviewed the 2021 EPA report entitled Guidance for Sample Collection for IVBA for Arsenic and Lead in Soil that serves as a key guidance document for application of RBA data in human health risk assessments. This last topic, application of RBA data to human health risk assessments, is the focus of today's webinar, where we will build upon the general overview provided in training session one. With that, let's jump into today's topic. We'll begin with a brief discussion of conceptual site models, or CSMs for short, and their use in human health risk assessment. CSMs are simple graphical representations of relationships between contaminant sources and receptors, taking into account things like chemical fate and transport, source and receiving media, and exposure pathways of concern to human health. CSMs are intended to be dynamic, iterative graphical models subject to evolve over time as information and data are collected. CSMs can help us understand what lead or arsenic sources may contribute to soil contamination. An understanding of contaminant sources can inform development or refinement of data quality objectives, including RBA data needs, along with decisions on how RBA data will be applied, something that will be discussed in more detail as we proceed today. Additionally, these conceptual site models help inform reasonable assumptions about RBA behavior at the site. For example, Multiple contaminant sources may release different forms of arsenic or lead to soil, including at different soil depths. Or timing of contaminant release may vary, or soil geochemical conditions may vary across the site. An understanding of these factors early in the risk assessment process is useful to develop reasonable assumptions about expected RBA behavior, whether that's at the scale of a given decision or exposure unit or for the site as a whole. And again, such understanding can be useful as the risk assessment proceeds with development and refinement of DQOs and sampling plans. A brief side note before we proceed. For simplicity of terminology, please note that I may use the terms decision unit and exposure unit interchangeably. While these two terms can have different meanings in different risk assessment contexts, today my intention is simply to use them to describe geographically subdivided units of an overall site that have been delineated to identify the scale at which exposure is to be assessed or remediation-based decisions are to be made. Finally, I want to emphasize here that every contaminated site is different, and therefore CSMs developed for each site will also be different. And by extension, this means that the data needs to characterize RBA and the manner in which RBA data are best applied may vary from site to site as well. So, how can RBA data be applied to improve the accuracy of human health risk assessments? Section 5 of EPA's 2021 guidance document for IVBA sample collection discusses four ways RBA data can be applied to risk assessments. They include 1, RBA adjustment of soil exposure point concentration, or EPC for short. 2, specific to lead, adjustment of bioavailability parameters in risk models, notably the Integrated Exposure Uptake Biokinetic Model, or IEUBK for short, or the Adult Lead Methodology, or ALM. For arsenic, adjustment of a soil contaminant daily oral intake. And finally, adjustment of risk-based screening or action levels. While we won't be covering each of these approaches comprehensively today, I will provide some examples in the next few slides, and we encourage you to review Section 5 of the guidance document shown here for more information as well, or reach out to the BAC committee for further guidance. In the context of soil arsenic or lead contaminated sites, the exposure point concentration is often defined as the average exposure experienced by a receptor within an exposure unit, which is then used in the risk assessment to calculate risk. As was discussed in training session one, to improve risk assessment accuracy, site or exposure unit-specific RBA data can be applied to adjust the EPC to represent the bioavailable concentration of arsenic or lead in soil, using the simple equation shown here, where the adjusted EPC in units of milligrams of bioavailable arsenic or lead per kilogram soil is equal to the total arsenic or lead soil concentration multiplied by RBA, expressed as a fraction ranging from 0 to 1. Alternatively, RBA data can be used to adjust lead exposure risk estimates calculated by the IEUBK model or the Adult Lead Methodology. These models estimate cumulative lead exposure risk across multiple media, including soil, dust, water, and diet. And therefore, soil RBA data will only be relevant to adjust specific parameters, specifically to adjust absorption fraction inputs for soil and dust. Before I proceed, I do want to point out that some of you may recall a discussion from training session one, where it was noted that EPA Method 1340, used to measure in vitro bioaccessibility to estimate RBA, has only been validated for use in soils, not dust. So, how can we apply RBA data to an absorption factor that combines both soil and dust? By default, both the IEUBK model and the Adult Lead Methodology only consider lead contributions to dust from soil. They do not account for other possible lead sources, like, for example, lead from indoor house paint. This is the basis by which it is considered reasonable to apply RBA data to a combined soil and dust absorption factor. Should you have any questions about this, there are panelists here today that can provide additional clarification. In the example shown here, soil and dust absorption fractions have been adjusted, assuming a default RBA value of 60%. For the IEUBK model, the input absorption fraction percent values for soil and dust of 30, shown here, are calculated by multiplying the absorption fraction percent assumed for soluble lead in drinking water of 50% by the default RBA assumption of 0.6, or 60%. If you instead wanted to apply a site or decision unit specific RBA value, you can do so by multiplying the absorption fraction percent for lead in drinking water by the site specific RBA value. If this value is less than 60%, then risk estimates derived from the IEUBK model would decrease when holding all other inputs constant. Whereas if the site-specific RBA value was greater than 60%, then risk estimates would increase, again holding all other model inputs constant. Similarly, for the adult lead methodology, applying default RBA assumptions of 60% would yield an adjusted combined soil and dust absorption fraction value of 0.12, as shown here. The absorption factor can instead be adjusted using site or decision unit specific RBA values that may vary from the default assumption of 60%. For arsenic, RBA can be used to adjust assumptions about daily oral intake of arsenic from soil ingestion. This is done by multiplying the daily intake value derived without considering bioavailability to either a measured site or DU specific RBA value or to an assumed default value of 60%. These adjusted daily intake values can then be compared to reference doses or cancer slope factor values. Before we break for our first Q&A round, I want to emphasize one very important point, and that is no double dipping. Imagine, if you will, that you're seated at a restaurant with your friends and you only have one tortilla chip, but four different dips lie in front of you on the table. Since you are a good human being, you don't want to double dip your chip into multiple dips. Therefore, you can choose to only try one dip. In this metaphor, that would be analogous to applying RBA data to one of the four approaches just discussed. Let's say instead that you want to try two dips. You could instead break your one chip into two pieces and deep dip each piece of that chip into two different dips. With RBA data, there may be situations where you want to break the chip into two. One example could be, say you initially used a default RBA value of 60% when running the IEUBK model to develop preliminary soil lead risk targets, and that this was done prior to the collection and analysis of soil samples to measure site-specific RBA across multiple decision or exposure units. If, after you measure RBA, imagine you find that the site-specific RBA value is only 30%. In this metaphor, that is like discovering that the size of your chip is twice as big as you originally assumed it was. Now you have one of two options. You could go back and rerun the IEUBK model for each and every decision unit across the site, or you could instead apply the remaining portion of RBA data to adjust the measured total soil lead concentration for each decision unit. In this example, what you are effectively doing is adjusting the exposure point concentration to be equal to the portion of bioavailable lead measured for each decision unit relative to the percent RBA that was applied to the IEUBK model. I recognize that this may be confusing for some. The goal today is not to cover every way RBA data can be correctly applied in every scenario imaginable, but rather to emphasize the point that you must be careful to correctly apply RBA data, especially considering that preferences may be site or situationally dependent. As a reminder, if you have any questions, we encourage you to reach out to the BAC committee for help when applying RBA data to your specific assessment. And with that, we will now break for our first of two Q&A rounds.
All right. At this time, I'm going to ask all of my panelists to go ahead and come on camera. And then the very next request that I'm going to make is to the live audience. If you have no questions at this time, go ahead and type a message into the Q&A that you have no questions at this time. If you are in the middle of typing a question, go ahead and carry on. We'll pause here for just a moment, but I wanted to be sure that we allowed time for questions to come in and then also tee up our panelists here if there are going to be some. So what I am seeing coming into the queue is many of the attendees are indicating that they have no questions at this time. But I do know that some of our attendees type long questions sometimes. So I want to hold here for just a second in case one of the attendees is in the midst of writing something a bit longer so that we can let them get that question in. Clay, while I'm holding here, I did just want to make an announcement for anyone who's having any difficulties viewing the slides, if they seem too small to you. Remember, you do have some view options. You may find that the view, full screen view, makes things better. You have some view options in the middle so you can zoom in on his slides as he's showing content. So if you can't read something, you can actually physically zoom in on it. And then I do have a direct link so you can download the slides directly if you'd like to reference them. A few attendees have been asking to go back to other slides so they could look at them. And I think the easiest thing is for me to give you all copies of those slides so you can kind of flip back and forth as needed in the presentation. But I do see a question. I knew if we held tight, one would come in. and I'm just going to take this one, Clay, if it's okay. Does the method work with lead and arsenic contamination that is present in different states, for example, elemental lead and its oxides?
Let's see. The method works so long as it is lead or arsenic in soil. So the form of lead or arsenic, whether it's a mineral phase or some other form, will impact its bioavailability. But the method 1340 is, again, designed to work with any contaminant source of lead or arsenic specific to soil contamination.
Okay. I do see a question that came in. If you have bioavailable data from an old study, is there any reason to run a new bioavailability test with the new method?
So that's a good question. And it kind of gets into the second half of today's talk. That being said, the answer is it depends, and it will depend in part on what your data quality objectives and data quality targets are and what you think the impacts of the decision you make whether to use old RBA data are appropriate. And if any other panelists have anything to add to that, I will pause for a moment.
All right. I don't think anyone else is going to unmute or chime in here, Clay. I'm looking at the screen with them. We did have an observation, though, that 1340 was developed for lead in soil. They wonder if the panel believes that is equally representative and accurate for arsenic, given that it is a model for gastric, so pHs of 1.5 oxic fluid.
So it has been developed and validated for arsenic. I don't know this for sure, but if you just search method 1340, you will often find an older version of the document that's specific to lead. But there has been some more recent documentation that is available. If anyone would like to see it, just I would recommend emailing the BAC committee. But there's both peer-reviewed studies and then subsequent EPA guidance documents that show that it's the same extraction method has been validated to work for arsenic in soils as well.
Okay, I see one more question that came in. And this one is asking, does the arsenic RBA calculation use swine model parameters that are specific to arsenic absorption?
So I would have Karen answer this, but she's not feeling well. So I'll just instead to ask her to to chime in if she disagrees with anything I've said. But arsenic was actually validated using a mouse model. Was there also juvenile swine included in that? Okay, so it was developed and validated using both mice and juvenile swine.
All right. Excellent. Thank you so much. Well, I don't see any other questions in the queue. So I think at this time, what we'll do is we'll go ahead and carry on with the presentation. But I do want to remind the audience that you can keep submitting those questions and comments into that Q&A window, and we will pause again in just a little bit for another Q&A break. So, Clay, I'll turn it back to you.
All right. Thanks, Jean. All right. Well, welcome back. We're now going to talk about systematic planning for development of data quality objectives when RBA data is used in risk assessment of soil arsenic or lead contaminated sites. To start, EPA has published a 2006 report on guidance on systematic planning using the data quality objectives process. The text from that report, copied here, does an excellent job of explaining the DQO process. So instead of reinventing the wheel, I will simply read the text verbatim. The DQO process is a series of logical steps that guides managers or staff to a plan for resource-effective acquisition of environmental data. It is both flexible and iterative and applies to both decision-making, for example, compliance or non-compliance with a standard, and estimation, for example, ascertaining the mean concentration level of a contaminant. The DQO process is used to establish performance and acceptance criteria, which serve as the basis for designing a plan for collecting data of sufficient quality and quantity to support the goals of the study. As with planning for collection of any environmental data, DQOs should be developed for RBA data collection as well. The 2006 guidance document outlines a seven-step process for development of DQOs. They are 1, state the problem, 2, identify the goal or goals of the study, 3, identify information inputs, 4, define the boundaries in both space and time of the study, 5, develop the analytical approach, 6, specify the performance criteria, and finally, 7, develop a detailed plan for obtaining data. In these next few slides, we will quickly walk through each step of the process, with an emphasis on the application of soil arsenic or lead RBA data, and provide examples of appropriate statements for each step. These examples are purely hypothetical and, for the sake of time today, may be an oversimplification of the level of detail that is likely warranted for each step. Nonetheless, hopefully these examples are informative. The first step of the DQO process is to state the problem. In this example, a stated problem may be there is a concern of unacceptable human health risk from exposure to lead-contaminated soil via the incidental soil ingestion pathway. Step two is to identify study goals. Here, one goal may be to determine if the mean RBA-adjusted soil lead concentration exceeds the target risk level. Next, we identify information inputs. With respect to soil arsenic or lead RBA data, information inputs may include the site-specific target risk level or action level, total soil lead concentration data, and in vitro bioaccessibility data, which we use to estimate RBA. Step four is to identify study boundaries in both space and time. Examples here might include to identify the geographical extent of the site and how it will be subdivided into decision or exposure units, and to identify temporal boundaries. In this example, one such boundary may be to only include data collected from 2017 to present that was obtained in compliance with an EPA-approved Quality Assurance Action Plan. Next, we define analytical approaches to obtain or measure data. For total metal concentration, an example may be to specify use of EPA methods 1350 or 1351 for digestion of samples for totals analysis, with analysis by ICP-OES or mass spec in accordance with EPA methods 6010 or 60-20 respectively. For IVBA data, the approach may be to collect data in accordance with EPA Method 1340, EPA's validated method for measuring soil arsenic or lead IVBA. Step 6 is to identify performance criteria. Consistent with guidance described in EPA's 2021 report for sample collection for IVBA, one of the documents referenced earlier in today's talk, performance criteria may include a goal of having a less than 5% probability of making a false compliance decision error and a less than 20% probability of making a false exceedance decision error. Before we move on to step 7, I want to take a few minutes to A, explain what is meant by a false compliance or exceedance decision error, and B, provide examples of sources of error or uncertainty that may contribute to making a decision error. The 2021 EPA guidance document on IVBA sampling defines a false compliance decision error as occurring when the measured exposure point concentration for a decision unit is determined to be below the site-specific action level, when the true EPC for the DU is, in fact, greater than the action level. One possible consequence of making a false compliance decision error is that it is determined that a given decision unit does not require remediation-based action, when it should have. Similarly, a false exceedance decision error occurs when the measured exposure point concentration for a decision unit is determined to be above the site-specific action level when the true EPC for the decision unit is, in fact, below the action level. A possible consequence of making a false exceedance decision error is the determination that a decision unit does not require remediation-based action when such action may, excuse me, to determine that a decision unit does require remediation-based action when such action may have been unnecessary. The different goals for false compliance and false exceedance decision error shown here reflect the idea that it is more important to be appropriately protective of human health than it is to be overprotective. So what are some examples of sources of error or uncertainty that may contribute to making a decision error? Imagine a lead contaminated site with a site-specific action level of 240 milligrams of bioavailable lead per kilogram soil. Next, imagine that a particular decision unit at that site has a true mean bioavailable lead concentration of 270 milligrams of bioavailable lead per kilogram soil. In this example, the correct assessment would be that the decision unit's mean bioavailable lead concentration exceeds the action level. Next, imagine that we implemented a sampling plan of collecting 5 samples from the DU to measure both total lead concentration and IVBA, which again we use to estimate RBA. And please note that for this example, it does not matter whether these samples represent discrete or composite sampling. Each sample collected from the DU will have its own associated true values for total lead concentration and RBA that will differ from average values across the decision unit. When we measure each sample, we will also get measured values that may not perfectly match each sample's true value. So here I have populated the table with hypothetical values for each sample's true total lead concentration, its true RBA value, and its true bioavailable soil lead concentration, which we get by multiplying the sample's total lead concentration by percent RBA. I have also input hypothetical measured values for each sample. The bottom row shows average or mean values across the 5 samples collected and analyzed. The first source of error or uncertainty I want to highlight is what is commonly referred to as sample representativeness error. Because the 5 samples collected represent a subset of all soil across the decision unit, our true mean bioavailable lead concentration for the 5 samples may be different from the true mean bioavailable lead concentration for the DU as a whole. Generally speaking, the more soil we collect and analyze, whether that is by increasing the number of samples collected, or in the case of composite sampling, the number of sample increments per composite, the more likely it is that the measured mean bioavailable lead concentration for our samples will be closer to the true mean bioavailable lead concentration for the decision unit as a whole. The next source of error I want to highlight is measurement error. Analytical data is not perfect. When we measure samples, we expect some error or variability in our measured values relative to the sample's true value. Here, our measured mean bioavailable lead concentration of 222 parts per million is slightly lower than the true mean bioavailable concentration across the five samples collected. When we combine sample representativeness error with measurement error, we get total error, where total error here means the total error from each source considered. It's certainly possible that there are other sources of error that exist that may not have been considered. So in this example, our measured mean bioavailable lead concentration across the five samples is 222 milligrams of bioavailable lead per kilogram of soil, which is below the 240 part per million action level. And this occurs from a hypothetical decision unit with a true bioavailable lead concentration of 270 milligrams per kilogram, or I should specify a true mean bioavailable lead concentration of 270 milligrams per kilogram. Here, we have an example of making a false compliance decision error, where our data leads to the incorrect assessment that the measured exposure point concentration is below the site-specific action level, when the decision or exposure unit's true EPC is, in fact, greater than the action level. This is a topic that we will revisit in greater detail in training session 3, focused on sample planning to meet site assessment decision confidence objectives, currently scheduled for March 18th. In this upcoming training session, we will also discuss ways to estimate decision error probability based on the sample plan being implemented and to reassess our estimates of decision error once samples have been collected and data analyzed. And finally, the seventh and final step of the seven-step DQO process is to develop a data and sampling plan, including decisions about whether default RBA assumptions or site-specific RBA measurements will be used. Where site-specific RBA data is to be applied, a subsequent decision is whether to measure and apply a site-wide RBA estimate or collect IVBA samples from every decision or exposure unit to apply RBA data at this finer scale, something we will discuss more in the next slide. Decisions about the type of sampling to be conducted, notably discrete or composite sampling, may also be considered here. The sampling plan should also consider statistical methods to determine the minimum sample number needed to satisfy data quality objectives. Again, this is a topic that will be further covered in training session 3. Lastly, it is important to note that selection of soils for RBA assessment should be done in a manner that avoids biasing the data. For example, if the DQO is to estimate a site-wide RBA, selection of soils based only on total metal concentration may bias the site-wide RBA estimate if some areas of the site are sampled less densely than others. And this consideration is particularly important if IVBA data is only collected from a subset of decision or exposure units across the site. An alternative to selection of soils for RBA assessment based on total metal concentration is to select a random sample of soils and then analyze the data for RBA variance attributable to concentration. This approach may be preferable given the relatively low additional expense of IVBA assays, the importance of understanding variability, and the need for samples to be representative, particularly when evaluated against the cost of greater uncertainty and assessed risk that would result if less or no IVBA data was collected, as higher uncertainty means a greater chance of making a false compliance or false exceedance decision error. While estimation of a site-wide RBA value may appear more convenient than collecting IVBA samples from every decision or exposure unit from a data collection standpoint, it is important to understand the limitations of where this may or may not be appropriate. One of, if not the most important factor to consider, is whether or not it is reasonable to assume that soil lead or arsenic percent RBA will be consistent across the site. Factors that can contribute to greater variability in RBA across the site include whether there is one or more sources of contamination, spatial or temporal variability in contamination pathways, and variability in soil geochemical properties known to influence soil arsenic or lead bioavailability across the site. Generally speaking, use of a site-wide RBA value will have a greater likelihood of over or underestimating RBA at the scale of a given decision or exposure unit, leading to lower confidence in the measured EPC or adjusted action level for that unit. In cases where only a subset of decision or exposure units are assessed for RBA, then data quality objectives should address both a plan for selecting DUs for RBA measurement that ensures resulting data can be used to predict RBAs at DUs not selected for direct RBA assessment, and also statistics to be used to represent RBA at DUs not selected for direct measurement of IVBA. One aspect of soil geochemistry known to influence RBA values is mineralogy and speciation data. When available, such data can be useful to predict or explain variability in RBA across the site. For example, generally speaking, amorphous surface-absorbed arsenic or lead tends to be higher in soil bioavailability than mineral phases when arsenic or lead are largely contained inside a crystalline mineral structure. Oxidation states of arsenic and lead can also contribute to variation in RBA. If mineralogy and speciation data is not already available, however, the value of obtaining such data should be weighed against that from simply collecting and analyzing more samples for IVBA. Speciation data is technically complex and is often applied to a relatively small subset of samples, primarily for the purposes of explaining observed RBA behavior rather than for predicting RBA in lieu of direct measurements of IVBA. Let's quickly talk about retrospective RBA assessments. In some cases, RBA data may not have been collected as part of the original risk assessment, but there is interest in collecting and applying RBA data retrospectively at that site. Such assessments are often performed on archived soil samples that were originally collected for some other purpose. In these instances, the original sample design likely did not include DQOs specific to RBA characterization. Development of additional data quality objectives for retrospective RBA assessment is advised. In most cases, the use of archived samples for RBA assessment should be thought of as convenient samples, with the reasonable expectation that use of such samples may contribute to uncertainty in RBA estimates. That being said, it is also reasonable to assume that retrospective RBA assessment using data generated from archived soil samples will increase the accuracy of the overall risk assessment when compared to not considering RBA data at all. And this slide was a bit of, if I heard the question correctly, the opposite scenario that the person asking the question asked with respect to having RBA data that was previously collected and applying it to the site. But the same general rules would apply where it would be advisable to include additional data quality objectives associated with that process, and the use of such data needs to be defensible. And lastly for today, just as it is critical to develop appropriate data quality objectives prior to the collection of data, it is equally critical that resulting data derived from sampling be evaluated to assess not only whether QC and data quality objectives were met, but also whether the observed data supports assumptions made as part of the DQO development and sample planning process. For example, if a site-wide RBA value was used because it was deemed reasonable to assume variability in RBA across the site was reasonably low, only to observe high variability in RBA from sampling, such discrepancies should be noticed and correctly addressed. Similarly, statistical approaches used to estimate false compliance and false exceedance decision error probability require certain assumptions be made, often prior to the collection of data, and it is important to reevaluate the appropriateness of these assumptions once data has been collected, a topic that will be addressed when we meet next for training session 3, currently scheduled for Monday, March 18th. So this concludes the presentation portion of training session 2. As a reminder, for more information or if you have questions that were not addressed today, please reach out to the BAC co-chairs listed here, email the BAC hotline, or take a look at the BAC website. And again, today's webinar is the second of a four-part series on assessment of soil arsenic and lead RBA in human health risk assessment. Dates and topics for the final two sessions are shown here. And with that, I will turn it back to Jean to lead us into our second and final Q&A session for today.
All right. Thank you so very much, Clay. At this time, again, I will kindly invite my panelists to turn on their video. And as they are doing that, I will provide a quick reminder to the audience. You may continue to submit your comments and questions in writing through the Q&A space. I do see a few of you with hands raised. That would be a request to verbally share a question or comment. At this time, I'm going to go ahead and lower those hands. But if you did have your hand raised and you would like to speak, if you can send a message into the Q&A and let me know that you prefer to share your comment verbally, we'll see how we're doing with time to see if we can take some of those questions and comments verbally. Sometimes I notice people raise their hands by accident. So if you weren't intending to raise your hand, I've lowered it. If you intended to, raise it again and then just send me a message in that Q&A. I'll also go ahead and kindly ask the attendees, if you have no questions, go ahead and share that message in the Q&A space. That's equally as helpful to us to know that we've made enough time and that we're not waiting for additional questions to come in. And while that messaging starts to queue up, I do have some questions that came in earlier. And you've got the slide up with the website now. So there are a few people who are wondering how they can access this updated information, and some asking if there's a listserv because they didn't know this update had been released. So Clay, if they were looking to get their hands on the updated methodology and information, would you recommend that website? Is there any way or any other way they can stay updated?
I'm going to hand that over to EPA person. So Matt, Sydney, or Karen, if you want to take that one.
Yeah, I can I can weigh in. The website is the best place for that. We do not have a web server. And yeah, you'll find the contact info that's listed here is also listed there. But BA Help gets you our hotline, and we can help you from there.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah, thank you.
If you have trouble finding the arsenic information via searching EPA method 1340, you can also find it, and I may be remembering, it's method 9200.886 or something like that.
I forget what that number was, but it is on this webpage.
Okay.
And if you go to that webpage, go to the guidance tab, and on the guidance tab, you'll find it under metals. You know, there's a metal section, and then it breaks out the lead and arsenic, but the method itself is under the metals heading.
Okay. All right. We do have some questions that are coming into the queue. So I want to thank the audience for sharing those, as well as those of you who've chimed in that you yourself don't have any questions. So I do think we'll take a few more here and see if any more comes in. One of our attendees asked if you could explain the difference between true and measured values. Is the quote true value the laboratory results and the quote measured values derived before sampling from the risk assessment model?
That's a great question. True values are in a sense, even though it really exists, it's the true value that would be obtained if there are no sources of error in obtaining that value. So if there is no analytical error whatsoever, no sample representativeness error whatsoever, no error of any kind, that would represent the sample's true value. I say it's quasi-hypothetical in that we will never know the sample's true value with 100% absolute certainty, but from a statistical standpoint, we can use that term to estimate false compliance and false exceedance decision error. Whereas measured values indicate those values derived from collecting samples and analyzing them.
Okay. All right. Looking here at our next question. For a retrospective assessment, is it advisable to collect new soil samples for IVBA analysis rather than using the archive samples that have already been analyzed for total lead? They go on to ask if you collect new soil samples, should they be run for IVBA and total lead?
Gary, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure, I will invoke the DQO. I mean, what was the intended use of the total lead levels? What would be the rationale for resampling or not resampling? If you had, for example, a DQO driven a sample plan to measure lead concentration at the DU, and you're happy with that, then measuring the archive samples, the RBA and the archive samples may be sufficient. On the other hand, if you have some concern about getting updated information, or you feel your DQOs weren't satisfied, your decision errors weren't satisfied when you sampled for concentration, maybe there would be a reason for resampling. So I think it would be depend on the site and your thoughts about, in general, about what decision errors might be tolerated at the site.
Yeah, just to add that, I understand it can be a frustrating answer, but the best answer is in this case, it depends. There are some situations where, when factoring in all factors, the better decision is to use archived soils, and there are some situations where it may be desirable to go back and collect new data or new samples for measurement.
Certainly, from a cost perspective, it's a lot less expensive to develop a sampling design for your archive, if you will, rather than going back in the field. But there might be reasons why you would want to collect new data.
And just to add on, oh, go ahead, whoever was.
Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say that we just had an inquiry on our hotline as to the shelf life of samples, and I believe the method states 6 months for a holding time. That is just a default that is used by the program for method and shelf life of samples. We have not done any formal study on, how long you can archive those samples for and still have the data be good, but we also have seen no reason to think that dried sieve samples stored in a dark place, are going to change the IVBA that much. So, we don't have any strong recommendations on going back to samples, many years later, but they do seem shelf stable.
And just as a reminder, even if your only option is to use archived soils to generate RBA data, it's reasonable to assume that doing so, even if it comes with a little bit more uncertainty in the RBA measurement, is again, in most situations, likely to lead to a more accurate assessment of risk than not including RBA data at all.
Okay. Speaking of Handling those samples and sieving, we did have a question that came in asking if you could talk about any IVBA challenges with the processing of soil data, like sieving or grinding. They comment that it seems like this method would be very sensitive to particle size.
So I will start by saying that's a great question that will be discussed in training session four. So I would encourage everyone to join for that one. As far as questions about particle size, that is one of many factors that was considered in development of EPA method 1340. So soil is sieved down to a certain particle size fraction. Karen, you can just shake your head, but I believe the current guidance is less than 150 micron. Yep. And so my understanding is that the logic behind that is that's the particle size that tends to most likely adhere to hands and to be ingested via the incidental soil ingestion pathway. So that is why, if you look at the method, it does require sieving the soils and only measuring a certain size fraction. But that is another sample processing part of running the assay for sure.
Okay, and then we did also have a comment that that grinding is not recommended in method 1340.
Yep. Karen, you're shaking your head. Yes. So we'll agree with that statement.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Okay, let's go to another question here. Is it appropriate to apply RBA to soil exposure point concentrations or EPCs when these EPCs were calculated using samples that were not sieved? And they clarify, right, just as you were discussing, that my understanding is that IVBA samples are sieved prior to the analysis.
Gary, do you have thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I would caution applying method 1340 at 150 microns to a bulk or 2 millimeter sieved soil sample. There's lots of reasons why the concentration and the RBA might be different between the fine fraction and the bulk sample.
But again, the sieving is only needed for the IVBA portion of the assay. So if you develop an EPC based off of a total measured concentration using traditional total digestion analysis methodology, that's commonplace. There's nothing weird or unusual or wrong with that, correct?
It would be weird and unusual for doing a lead, an incidental soil ingestion pathway assessment because you are interested in the RBA adjusted concentration in the fine fraction that adheres to skin. But
Okay.
maybe.
Yep. Nope. As soon as I said that, I almost wanted to retract my statement. So thanks for clarifying.
Okay. Let's ask this next one. Is it appropriate to assume that dust RBA is equal to soil RBA in the IEUBK model? They go on to say, since the indoor dust is assumed to be entirely attributable to soil.
Amber?
Yes, that is correct. So in the IEUBK model, you can apply the same RBA to soil and dust because of that underlying assumption that soil is contributing primarily to indoor dust.
Okay. And then just to confirm, the IVBA method, can it be used for dust?
So it has not been validated for use in dust outside of the use of RBA data to adjust combined soil and dust absorption fraction percentages, which in and of itself isn't something that's validated. It's just considered reasonable and common practice. So the method 1340 has only been validated in terms of measuring IVBA for soils. It has been used in the peer-reviewed literature to measure dust IVBA. So you can look into that peer-reviewed literature to see how it has been applied to dust samples, but that's not something that again, for my understanding, that's not something that is currently applied in risk assessment beyond adjustment of the combined soil and dust absorption factors in those models.
Okay. We had a question that came in asking, should soil samples collected for contaminant analysis and IVBA analysis be collected using the same methodology, for example, discrete versus incremental sampling, or can the methods differ for comparison?
The methods can differ. That would need to be something that's considered and discussed as part of your DQO development process. And there may be reasons for doing that. It may make it harder or more challenging to estimate your false compliance and false exceedance decision error probabilities. Like many things in the risk assessment process, there's always trade-offs that need to be evaluated. And one decision may have some benefits, but come at be associated with some costs. So those trade-offs just need to be assessed.
Okay. All right. Our next question. One of the attendees wondered again if you could go back to the consideration of limitations and caveats when you're using RBA. Are there circumstances where using RBA just isn't appropriate, where the total metal is better? For example, if you have a site with changing redox conditions where exposure is the same.
Gary, do you have thoughts on that one? Or I can't think of a situation off the top of my head, but I don't want to say that because I can't think of one. One doesn't exist. So I don't know if any other panelists can think of.
Well, I mean, in one, there is at least one caveat, and I'm sure Karen and others can remember others, but one is we haven't found method 1314 to be very successful at predicting RBA of soils that have been heavily laced with phosphate for lowering lead bioavailability. So that's just one example.
And we didn't get into it today, but there are situations where the total concentration is so high that including RBA data would not change any risk determinations or remediation-based decisions. And it would, while it wouldn't necessarily be wrong to consider RBA, it may be unnecessary and therefore a waste of resources of time and money. So there are situations where it may not make sense to go down the RBA road.
And possibly what the submitter was getting at was if you have a situation where you think RBA might be changing
Right.
over time, that's certainly something that you'd want to consider in developing your DQOs. But ultimately, I would think you would need to test that to be sure that was actually happening, that IVBA or RBA was temporarily varying, and that might certainly shape your DQO and your sampling design, including possibly resampling,
Right.
for example.
And just to build upon that, specifically with arsenic, the default value of 60% RBA that can be applied for arsenic without the need to collect any data has been developed by looking at RBA values across many, many soil samples. And 95% of the time, RBA is less than 60%. So if you're concerned about redox conditions resulting in changes in bioavailability over time, as part of your DQOs, you may choose to not measure site-specific RBA or apply a mean RBA value to that. You might provide an upper estimate of what you think would likely to occur based on the site-specific conditions. So in the case of arsenic, you may say, well, we're just going to stick with the 60% default value rather than going and collecting site-specific data. Lead's a little bit different because the default value is based off of central tendency of 60%, not an upper confidence value. But you could still consider what you think might be an upper confidence limit and apply that as your RBA value rather than a mean or measure of across your IVBA measurements. So that would be one example of how you might still include RBA data under that situation.
I want to point out that the method, if you go read the method, it has some caveats in there. We mentioned the phosphate. That's an important one for us. There's also a saturation point for both arsenic and for lead that's mentioned in there. Those are very high. You would very rarely see it. For documentation, that's a good place to go. And then on the redox conditions, we have taken some samples in both reduced and ox most of the samples were oxidized. And that's kind of your anticipated condition for soils. But certainly we've seen some redox situations where you're sampling reduced soils or wetland stuff. And it does not appear to impact the results. Just not to say it never would. So Gary or Clay, I forget who said it, but it bears testing. So far, that does not to be that important.
Okay. We did have a follow-up that came into that question. The questioner wanted to know if they can assume that an RBA adjusted PRG that was calculated using the IVBA model should then not be applied or compared to unsieved total metal sampling results or EPCs.
Amber, do you have a thought on that?
And I think the same answer kind of applies, but I will say that sieving is recommended for lead for risk assessment. Once you get into risk management, I'll defer to my EPA panelists here to maybe chime in.
Yeah, I would just encourage the person who asked the question. That's the type of question that's a good follow-up question to go through the BAC committee. Some questions may appear simple, but can be complex and require a little bit of time to give the correct answer to. And that may be, I'm not saying it is, but it may be an
Well,
example of that.
we see this question come up occasionally because sometimes total metals unsieved bulk samples are used to support ERAs, ecological risk assessments, and for very good, economics, one would like to be able to use those concentrations for human health risk assessment, but. To me, from my perspective, again, I'm not EPA, I'm the CERC. I don't think that's advisable. I think if you want to know, if you're looking at the trying to estimate the risk of the incidental ingestion of soil from children, which largely occurs from hand-to-mouth activity, you really need to know the RBA adjusted concentration and the fraction that binds to, that attaches to soil, and that should be. EPA has determined that that should be at, in the less than 150 micron. So my response to that is, after a long-winded response, which should have been no, I wouldn't recommend doing that.
So it isn't uncommon once we move past the risk assessment and you're looking at finish up your site characterization, looking at FS things, or even later and assessing compliance with cleanup levels to not sieve. But I think what we want to make sure we have is a through line from the what triggers us into an action where we get our risk, how we're quantifying that risk, setting our goals. We want to maintain the continuity. So in the case of lead and arsenic, where you've modified your RBA, you've got site-specific RBA. I think it's worth keeping the sieve soils for those later purposes. It does make a difference in terms of the results we'll see. There's a reason we're looking at the finest fraction here. So I think It's not uncommon for other purposes than risk assessment to do it, but it goes back to your DQOs and maintaining that consistency.
Okay. Clay, I'm going to send another question your way. How would the presence of gerosite in the soil impact the use of IVBA to characterize RBA?
IVBA works great. You're assuming, I believe this is related specifically to lead. It's been shown in the peer-reviewed literature that jarosite is a form, a lead-containing form, or plumbojarosite, I believe specifically. Don't quote me on that, but you can use the IVBA assay, and you're likely to find that bioaccessibility is very, very low in that situation. And that can be a good thing. But again, the IVBA assay is perfectly acceptable to use for those type of mineral phases in soil.
And it can bind arsenic as well, but I think the research focus right now is on lead. So
Okay. We did have a question, and I see a response from Karen. So, Karen, if you can nod, I will read your response vocally for you to this question on the solution composition. So, if that's okay, I will vocalize on, I will be Karen's voice. But one of the attendees asked, what is the solution composition recommended for the IVBA method? And Karen shared this response that solution composition is 0.5 molar glycine solution adjusted to pH 1.5, and that additional details are listed in EPA method 1340. Thank you. Related to that, if we're collecting new IVBA data, should both the gastric and intestinal synthetic solutions be included?
Not if you're following EPA method 1340. EPA method
Okay.
1340 is a gastric phase only assay. There are other in vitro methods that have been developed elsewhere, whether that's other countries or perhaps in academia, that include multiple phases. And so if you want to be compliant with EPA method 1340, it would, again, that's just a gastric phase assay, and that's what EPA has validated. If you, for whatever reason, wanted to use another in vitro, a bioaccessibility assay that's multi-phase, I guess you could choose to do so as long as that's consistent with rules, regulations, and compliance requirements for your specific site assessment.
All right, and the last question I see in the queue, this is getting back to archive soils. What if a lab returned soils to you when they did analysis? Could you use archive soils that have already been run for total lead method EPA 6010D as in dog for IVBA analysis?
So if by that they mean a sample was sent to a lab, an aliquot of that sample was taken for totals analysis, and then the remainder of that soil was sent for IVBA analysis. Again, there's certain, as Matt alluded to, there's certain best practices and recommendations with sample hold time, preferably. Any movement of soil would be have been performed under chain of custody, so you can track the conditions and storage of those soils over time. But if upon review of all those factors, I don't inherently see any issue with that scenario. If anyone else, any of the other panelists can think of, want to add to that.
Don't see any heads or unmuting. So I think.
Yeah. Again, I would just want to make sure that there's a ideally a chain of custody for those soils, and you know how they were stored and how long they've been held, and use those to inform whether that's a reasonable thing to do or not.
All right. Well, by my time check here, it is 2:14, and I do not see any additional questions in the queue right now, and there are no hands up. So, Clay, I think at this time we'll go ahead and wrap up, but I would ask if you could go back to the previous slide, and I just wanted to go back to a statement that you made on one of the other questions. If the audience has follow-on questions, has specific questions for their site, their scenario, their samples, they can reach out to the individuals here for help or questions.
Yes, I mean, if it's it may be preferable just to email the BAC email address,
Okay.
because that's the direct, I mean, that's the address that's monitored and tracked. If you email one of the co-chairs, they would probably just pass it along to the larger BAC group anyways. So the most direct route for the best help would be to e oops, I can't highlight, but to email the BA help at epa.gov.
All right, excellent. Well, I think we are nearing our time here to go ahead and wrap things up. So, if it's okay with all of my panelists, what I'm going to do is go ahead and walk through some final reminders. If I can get a nod of some heads here. Yes, it's all right. All right, excellent. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. So before my audience departs, let me walk through a few quick final reminders. I want to start first by saying thank you to our presenters. I want to thank you, Clay, for sharing and delivering that presentation, as well as our whole suite of panelists who joined us to help field those questions. I'm going to walk through a few quick final reminders before we close things out today. So, I know there were questions about how to stay updated, and I might encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org for information related to hazardous waste site characterization and cleanup, and to sign up for our free monthly newsletter. I send out a collection of new websites, documents, online events, training conferences through TechDirect on the first of each month, where sessions like today's would be highlighted. So, if you're not a subscriber, I encourage you to sign up for TechDirect. I'll also let everybody know that we do have that unique seminar homepage. So I shared that link at the start of today's session, and I will just remind everybody that that link is available from today forward. I have placed that URL as a open chat to you all, so you can click on the chat button and you'll see a series of links that I've highlighted. The last one that I just put in was a link to the seminar homepage. On that seminar homepage, you can download the presentation materials as well as access some of the resources that were highlighted in Clay's presentation. I've included those links and email addresses as well in the meeting chat, but honestly, go to the seminar homepage. All of the information is posted there. I will point out that there are various sections on this page, so you may find it helpful to use the plus and minus icons to collapse or expand or scroll up and down to the section of interest. For those of you who are looking for a participation certificate, if you take just a moment, visit the seminar homepage and fill out our feedback form. Once you fill that form out and check the box at the bottom to certify you are here for the entire delivery, as soon as you send your feedback in, you'll then immediately have access to a certificate of participation that you can save or print out for your own records. So if you happen to host a viewing party at your location, each person who sat and watched with you can fill out that form on their own, even if they didn't register. So again, if you were the one who registered, send the link to the homepage to your colleagues who joined you at your location. Let them fill out the feedback form on their own, and everyone will get a certificate for their own records. And then we did record today's session. So if you happen to be one of the lucky ones who is watching the archived version of today's session, you will find a button right above my head now in the archived version in the upper right that will point you to this seminar homepage where you can jump over to the feedback form and share your feedback for the replay of the session. Again, make sure you check the box at the bottom certifying you watched the entire archive, and you can still get a certificate based off of your replay. I promise you, we do read each and every submission in the feedback form, and it does help us to continue to offer free online sessions. So we do look forward and encourage you to share your thoughts with us. The last reminder that I have is just as Clay was pointing out, this is the second in a multi-part series. So there are two more sessions currently scheduled on this topic. So I will encourage you to sign up for the remaining two if you haven't done so already. Part three and part four will be hosted on March 18th and April 1st, respectively. We have registration open on the CLUIN website. I put direct links to those seminar homepages in the meeting chat as well, so you can click and sign up for those. We also have archived part one. So if you didn't join us for the first delivery on February 12th, you can head over again to the CLUIN seminar page and browse through our archive sessions to replay part one. This session will be posted on that archive in just a few days. So again, you'll be able to replay everything and point your colleagues to it. So, with those quick reminders, I do want to thank everyone who joined us. So, we hope this was a valuable expenditure of your time, and we'll see you on a future internet seminar. With that, I'll formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.